Marty Bax and Carmen Romero, Donna, Joe, Billy, Joseph, Danny. I mean, there's a lot of people here that have, you know, Bo, that could tell you about, like I said, all the particulars. Mine's more emotional. Mine was more being in the trenches and getting those meetings started and sponsoring women, you know, and teaching them that they didn't have to exploit yourself to pay the bills anymore. You know, and that they can believe in a power greater than themselves and not have to be a male. You know, we can change here. Okay? And that the importance of the therapeutic value, not men's groups, not women's meetings, that I need to know what it felt like as a male to get raped in prison so that we can connect on that level of pain, that identification, so that we can start to recover. And had I gone, I used to go to meetings and people would say, women would say, this is not a women's meeting, I'm not going to share here. I'd be like, I'm dying here. I'm dying. And that is some of the things that were going on in the East Coast. It's not so much my ego or my personal story. There are other women that are shaking their heads that know that this is the stuff. Things started happening quick and fast, and we were losing sight, and everybody wanted to jog into position and create their own little corner of what Narcotics Anonymous said that they thought it was. But Narcotics Anonymous is a program of complete abstinence. That an addict, any addict, can only desire to stop using and find a new way of life. Our message is hope. And if you're new tonight, even if you're old tonight, the recipe is the same. Go to meetings. No, it doesn't change. Go to meetings no matter what. Pray. Get a higher power. Work the steps. Have a sponsor. Sponsor people. How simple is it? You know, and we all know, honestly, when you start looking at the service structure and it changes, if you really believe in what's going on, you need to talk to some of these other people and start looking at the service structure. You know, but we are the fellowship. This is Narcotics Anonymous. We are Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and that's not going to change. That's never going to change. I'm grateful for the people in these rooms that work before me, who love me. I'm grateful for the people in Connecticut who invited me here, who always make me feel welcome. Who my warriors, that were my warriors before my true warriors showed up, you know, they have my back today. And, you know, just to be a member, you know. Professionally, in my professional life, those of us that got clean in 1980s, most of us ended up working in the field. I do not have a master's degree, but I can tell you that I was one of the highest paid people in the state of Florida without a master's degree as a tech, not as a therapist. Want to know why? Because people from Pennsylvania that moved before that started the treatment center knew that I was in there, that knew I had a mouth, that I was going to stick to principle, and I was trustworthy. And I could follow direction. And I got hired. Why? Because I worked the 12 steps of my life. I understand the tradition. I know how to take direction. I know how to show up. I become a respectable, responsible member of society. And no, social acceptability does not equal recovery, but my recovery in Narcotics Anonymous spoke for itself. And that's not me, that's us. That is me. That's Narcotics Anonymous. We have changed the world. We have changed the world. We are the example for our kids and our grandkids. Okay? You come from a family of addiction, and like I did, their cycle has been broken. That's the movement of 1980. When the expansion of Narcotics Anonymous happened in 1980s, we changed families forever. To get a message from my daughter, who said, thank you for getting clean before I was born, Mom. That's a pretty profound statement. Okay? That's a huge, profound statement. And it doesn't matter the service positions that I serve, like volunteer, those things. You know what those are? They're service positions. That we were at the right place at the right time, nobody else wanted to do it, we said. Or we got competitive. You know what I mean? But you know the magic of that? We learned. We learned to grow up and we matured, and we became really decent human beings. You know, that title a lot, once an addict, always an addict, can no longer be tolerated. And that was the move in 1980. I was not going to be called a junkie bitch one more time. Okay? And I'm not today.
to hear the message speak through them. Not that we don't want to hear you. We'd love to talk to you afterward, but we want to respect you having to stage our lives up here tonight. Thank you. Without any further ado, we're going to go to my brother in the end over there. We're going to go to hear Vito's experience, strength, and hope. Brother Vito!
I'm an addict, Paul Vito. First of all, I'd like to thank this committee for having me come here. I didn't know I was even speaking tonight until about midnight last night. I talked to Tim Moncone. He said, come out, we'll find something for you to do. Here I am. I'm like Bob. What comes out of my mouth you may not like. Call your sponsor. You know, I came in here when I was 21, and I'm a man of my 70 now with great-grandchildren, so at this point I don't care what I say because it comes from my heart. I don't want to offend anybody, but I must be true to myself because that's what the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous taught me to be. You know, when I came in, there was no place for me to go. I was given a meeting list of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Vailburg section of Newark, New Jersey, with hair down on my ass, razor sharp garrison belt, spikes coming out of my engineer boots, earrings dangling down on my shoulder, and I walked into that room and some old man, he was probably 40, but when you're 21, turned around in a jacket and a tie and a crew cut and said to me, hey kid, what are you doing here? And I simply told him, because I got out of a place where they put me after I was homeless and dying, and I said, well, the place I came out from gave me this meeting list and said, if I come here, you got coffee and donuts. And that's a pretty big invite when you were homeless. And they said to me, I didn't belong. I was different. People like me don't get better. I have a disease that is immoral and antisocial. And as they escorted me physically to the door, they took my meeting list and circled meetings that were called open meetings and said, kid, you could go there, but why waste your time? People like you don't get better. You don't tell an addict not to come back. And so I started showing up at these big open meetings of that fellowship. And when I sat down, people shifted to the other side of the room. But something was happening in the early 1960s. More and more people like me showed up there. And we'd stand on the steps of those churches, and we'd share deep with each other like, hey man, what's happening? We'd go to the meeting, we'd sit together, and water things was all up. And on the street, and for the first 18 years of my recovery, I went by my street name, Ducci. But when I was in that fellowship, they gave me a new name called Animal. Because that's what they thought of people like me. But back in the 1960s, there was a lot of these hippie guys going around, the hippie gals. And I happened to be at one of those meetings of that fellowship, and in the back room there were some hippies who rented it. And they said they came down to San Diego, California, and they had a message that they picked up out there called Narcotics Anonymous. And I call that the first day of my life for a very simple reason. That was the day that I discovered there were people like me. You see, when that meeting didn't have literature like we have today, and I'll get back to the literature and how meetings were back then, but they opened the meeting up and they started to share, and I heard my thinking coming out of their mouth. And that process of identification let me know that there were other people like me. Because up to that time, I thought I was insane. And if you found out how I was thinking, you'd lock me up. Because I've been locked up. I've been in Bellevue. I grew up on the streets of the Bronx, and when they didn't know what to do with me, they'd stick me in first Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx and ship me down to Bellevue, and then out to Graymore. But I found out there's other people like me. And then when those hippies left off, we tried to get meetings going. And we had some hard times, and sometimes we had a meet in secret. And then I found out there was a meeting in Passaic, New Jersey called Narcotics Anonymous. And it wasn't from this fellowship. It was from Narcotics Anonymous Incorporated, New York. Danny Carlson's NA, which was before us. And lasted up until the late 60s. And there was a gal named Ray Lopez that was a friend of Danny's and kept it going. And we got some inspiration from them. It was a different fellowship than this fellowship. They had steps, but they didn't have traditions. Because their meeting spaces were funded by the New Jersey Department of Health. And the meetings they had in New York was funded by the New York City Health Department. But they were addicts. And so I had to go there occasionally, and I had to go to the other fellowship. But I kept in contact with one of the hippies who had gone back to San Diego. And I hitchhiked out there. When I got there, I thought I would find the land of Narcotics Anonymous. But there was only two meetings there. There was a Wednesday night meeting up on Mission Hill. And I sat at this guy's house in Old Town San Diego. And all day long, people were coming in and out. It was almost like dope deals. And finally, about 10 of us piled into a Volkswagen bus, those of you can remember those things. And we went up to Mission Hill to this great big Catholic church. And we're piling out of this Volkswagen bus, and the guy grabs me and he says, "Hey, Ducci," he said, "when you get out of here, don't mention NA or Narcotics Anonymous." I said, "We're going to NA meeting." He says, "We are, but the priest thinks we're AA. They don't rent the attics." So you see how resourceful addicts can be. Friday night, we had a meeting in East San Diego at the Black Panther Clubhouse. They gladly rented us, as long as we had the money. But the rest of the time, we had to go to the other fellowship. And sometimes our meetings would close for 2-3 months. They weren't there all the time. Because the one person that got the church, if he relapsed, and that happened a lot, you couldn't get back in because you had to have the contact because people didn't want. So meetings would be there and then they wouldn't be there and then they'd be there again. And so in San Diego I got my first taste of Narcotics Anonymous. And it was much different than what it was today. And a lot of people don't realize this, but in those meetings was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you would cross out alcohol and put in drugs and you'd cross all that thing out. And that went on right up into the 70s, almost to the time the basic text came out. You tell a lot of people today, they look at you like, what planet are you from? But it was. And that was part of the thing that the addicts that got involved in literature and wanted to write a book was our book, because that was their book. And sometimes if you wanted to do the steps, you had to go there and do cross-outs. And I stayed in San Diego almost to the late 60s, and by that time, I was actually starting to get better, but boy, I was sick when I came in here. And I was pursuing an education, and I had already got my master's, and I was pursuing to get a doctorate, and I had to finish it up. I had to go to Hong Kong. So I had to leave the States for a little while, went to Hong Kong, and then to India to do my dissertation, and there was no NA. And you couldn't even think of starting a meeting in those countries in those days, because you talk about drugs and narcotics, get you locked up. And so I had to go where I had to go for my recovery. But when I finished, I came back to Santa Barbara, and I was there for a safe short time, and I found a job, now that I got my papers, in Binghamton, New York. And I arrived in Binghamton, New York in 1976, and I bought a house in a place called Montrose, Pennsylvania, which was a suburb of Binghamton, New York. And in 1976, on Chenang, corner of Chenangle Street and Henry Street in Binghamton, New York, I started an NA meeting. And I believe that meeting, as last I knew, was still in existence today. And then I got transferred to a little town called Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania, which was halfway between Binghamton, New York and Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And there was no NA in Tunkhannock. But there was meetings in Scranton, and I didn't know about them. But part of my work took me into Wilkes-Barre, and in 1978, me and some other addicts that I ran into in the other fellowship, we started the acceptance group in SAC Church in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And I stayed in Wilkes-Barre for a number of years. And we found out there was meetings up in Lackawanna County, in Dunmore, in Scranton. And we hooked up with those people. And they had an area going. They had just broke from, they had a thing going in Pennsylvania before I got there called the Northern area, the Southern area. They meet every other month together. And that had just split up. And some people up in Scranton formed an area called the Wyoming Valley area. And so we, our loner group in Wilkes-Barre, we hooked up with them. We stayed with them for a few years. Until all of a sudden they started giving drinking rights to people. And so I remember the last day we had our area service there. The group, by that time, we had 10 or 11 groups in Wilkes-Barre, and we confronted the area, and the area told us to mind our own business, and we walked out of that area service meeting and went upstairs and formed the Beehive area. And during that time, a lot of buzz was going on. People were getting involved. I remember going to a picnic in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and going up to Kermit's van, and he had all these Jewish bandanas. And walking into Recovery First in Allentown and seeing the Pure shirt with big ECVC on it. For those of you who don't remember those days, it stood for East Coast Vigilante Committee. And it's not like the people who call themselves Purists today. Part of the Purism was talking about now we have our own book and we want to be compliant to the language in the book. And the purity they were talking about there was let's start talking the message of Narcotics Anonymous the way it's written in the book. Because sober and sobriety was very common. Because remember, there was no book. And it was just what they picked up from the big book. And all of a sudden, the guys on the literature committee had worked so hard, it came out. And we had our own language. And what the Purist movement was simply, let's clean up the language, the match of the basic text, and follow the traditions. And a lot of people got persecuted. I think there was 27 groups in Philadelphia that succeeded from Narcotics Anonymous. And formed what they called Addiction Anonymous because they didn't want to give up their big books. I remember Marty E. speaking at a convention in Philadelphia and people threw tomatoes at him because he stood up there and said, we have this book now, we don't need this book anymore. There was resistance. People would say, well, I got clean on this, why do I have to have that? And then there was the others who wanted this message and so forth. And there's many people that gave time. History is what you see in this room right here. History is people. Not just certain things, but people, the evolution. People getting involved. Group conscience. People would talk about the inverted pyramid, that the most important person was the member of the home group, and that it would go up. And how important the ninth tradition was. You know, how we go from one level, and the most important thing in Narcotics Anonymous is the individual group and group member. And it was carried through the levels, and it wasn't consensus-based. It was group conscience. Because if you couldn't get an overwhelming majority, then you just put it off and came back and dealt with it at another business meeting. You see, the growth of this fellowship was group conscience. And the people who did a lot of the work believed in group conscience. And people actually gave up their life for this fellowship. People lost marriages in those literature committees because they were devoted. And there's a lot of those people in this room today. You know, you got Paul, you got Jim Adams, you got Joseph P., and hundreds of other people who gave their lives and put everything else on hold for the book. And Jim M. out there in Nebraska, or Iowa, one of those states, going to donate blood so they can buy office supplies to work in their literature committee. People hitchhiking across the world, the country. That's NA history. That's people. People going out and starting meetings. Even those people who got resentments and bought a coffee pot and started a new meeting. I've often said, show me a controversy in the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, and I'll show you God creating a new situation. And so if you're afraid of controversy, you're afraid of growth. You know, they often say, if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for anything. And today, you know, our history dictates our future. And there's some things in our future that we must stand in today and learn from our history. Emerson wrote a whole article on history, and he said, if you don't know where you come from and you don't know your history, your future's going to be screwed up. And today we know group conscience works. We know group conscience put us where we are today. Don't let anybody ever take that away from you. I don't know where this fellowship is going to go, but I do know if people give their lives again for this fellowship, go to meetings, help the newcomer, follow the traditions, and don't let anybody tell you the traditions are worn out and they don't work. Don't let anybody tell you that the inverted pyramid never worked. At one of the recent workshops that are going around the country, I had somebody come up to me and say, first we had the tree, then we had the twig, then we had the guide to service, and it wound up being a pile of pulp. And I said to him, if it was pulp, why do we have so many meetings today? Why do we have people in groups life-saving? No, it's not pulp. It's not pulp. It's group conscience, it's addicts writing for each other, it's addicts participating in, and it's addicts who believe in total abstinence. I can remember a meeting when people would come in on methadone and they would count the days while their measure is being reduced so they can get totally off of it so they can participate and serve Narcotics Anonymous. You see, you don't have to stop using to become a member of this fellowship. You only have to have a desire. But you must be totally abstinent to serve this fellowship. You don't chair meetings. You don't be a speaker at a meeting if you're on methadone or Suboxone. You are where you are, and that's your business. And it's okay, and you can be a member. But the recovery process does not start until there's complete abstinence. The book says it. Replacement therapy. I used to participate in that when I was still using. Well, if I couldn't get heroin, I would get drug replacement therapy. I'd get some coke. Well, if I couldn't find any coke, then I'd get some pot. Drug replacement therapy. And I know that sounds far-fetched, but that's what drug replacement therapy is. That's what it says. Drug replacement therapy. Replace one drug with another. And I mean, I don't want to hurt people's feelings. And I know sometimes people need to be on methadone or Suboxone while they're in the process of getting clean. That's what it is. The process of getting clean. And I believe we have neat literature that says what clean time is. Not something that leaves it up to, well, it could be this, or it could be that, or it could be that. Just because we don't have a literature committee, why don't addicts start writing literature anyway and let God open the way for it to happen? Because if addicts all over the country start writing again, they have no choice but to start looking at it. It's the apathy today that is causing that. Having the literature we have, having the basic text was the greatest thing that ever happened, but apathy came in. And that's what allowed the literature committee to disappear. That's what allowed standing committees all around this fellowship to disappear. It's our apathy. We got what we wanted and we became complacent. And being complacent, complacent about our fellowship is just about as bad as being complacent about our recovery. I don't know what the answers are. I don't know what direction this fellowship's going to go. But I know I will show up in my home group. I will sponsor people. I will talk about traditions. I will talk about group conscience. And enough people do that, it will be a reality again. But it's up to me. It's up to you. It doesn't happen by osmosis. And it's sometimes unpopular to say, this is the direction we need to go. I believe we need to go from within, not from without. But if enough people want to go from within, changes will happen. It worked before, it will work again in the future. Because our history of our past can be our future again. Or it can go another direction. That's entirely up to the members of Narcotics Anonymous. And so if you love this fellowship, and if there's some areas of the fellowship you don't like what's happening, you don't need to form an army. Just get out and start doing things again. Start talking about literature and writing literature and send it in to them and overwhelm them with them so they say, the addicts out there want literature written by addicts for addicts. You see, there's some people that still stay and continue to write through the years. But unfortunately, it was only a handful. And so we go through our struggles. This weekend, get in touch with people. There's a lot of people here. There are people here that have as much time as me. You got Norm from Los Angeles, Gene from Portland, Oregon. You got Jimmy's daughter here this weekend. You got people that know the fellowship then and today. Pick their brains. Help them get their enthusiasm back to the way it was. Because when they get their enthusiasm, it'll be spread to you. Because the only way this fellowship grew and worked was from addicts sitting in rooms that got up and say, we have a dream. Someday we'll have a book. I remember my sponsor, Bob B., in 1978, I believe it was the World Convention, I can't remember if it was Houston or Dallas, but he was speaking in a room not even nowhere near the size of this, and he said, someday, I'll bet you we'll have a World Service office as big as this room. And it was a quarter the size of this. Because there was vision, there was dreams. And if you don't like what's going on, become a dreamer. Grab that rainbow again and be part of the solution. You don't have to have a revolution. You just need a solution. And there's a big difference. Do it for the love of the fellowship, not for the hate of something else. Because it's about love. We can't afford on us and them. It's all us. But if you get busy, the solution's in front of us. And a revolution will never do a solution. Gandhi defeated the entire British army without lifting anything through love. And if you love this fellowship, love in action. Thanks for letting me share.